Chapter 14. But at that very moment, the princess came in. There was a look of horror on her face when she saw them alone and their disturbed faces. Levin bowed to her and said nothing. Kitty didn't speak or lift her eyes. Thank God she's refused him, thought the mother, and her face lighted up with the habitual smile with which she greeted her guests on her Thursdays. She sat down and began questioning Levin about his life in the country. He sat down again, waiting for other visitors to arrive in order to retreat unnoticed. 5 minutes later, there arrived a friend of Kitty's, married the preceding winter, Countess Nordston. She was a thin, sallow, sickly, nervous woman with brilliant black eyes. She was fond of Kitty, and her affection for her showed itself, as the affection of married women for girls always does, in the desire to make a match for Kitty after her own ideal of married happiness. She wanted her to marry Vronsky. She had often met Levin at the Shishchebatskys' early in the winter, and she'd always disliked him. Her invariable and favourite pursuit when they met consisted of making fun of him. "I do like it when he looks down at me from the height of his grandeur, or breaks off his learned conversation with me because I'm a fool, or is condescending to me. I like that so, to see him condescending. I'm so glad he can't bear me," she used to say of him. She was right, for Levin actually couldn't bear her, and despised her for what she was proud of and regarded as a fine characteristic, her nervousness, her delicate contempt, and indifference for everything coarse and earthly. The Countess Nordston and Levin had got into that relation with one another not seldom seen in society, when two persons who remain externally on friendly terms despise each other to such a degree that they cannot even take each other seriously, and cannot even be offended by each other. The Countess Nordston pounced upon Levin at once. "Ah, Konstantin Dmitrievich, so you've come back to our corrupt Babylon," she said, giving him her tiny yellow hand, and recalling what he had chanced to say early in the winter, that Moscow was a Babylon. "Come, is Babylon reformed, or have you degenerated?" she added, glancing with a simper at Kitty. "It's very flattering for me, Countess, that you remember my words so well," responded Levin, who had succeeded in recovering his composure, and at once, from habit, dropped into his tone of joking hostility to the Countess Nordston. "They must certainly make a great impression on you." "Oh, I should think so. I always note it all down. Well, Kitty, have you been skating again?" And she began talking to Kitty. Awkward as it was for Levin to withdraw now, it would still have been easier for him to suffer this awkwardness than to remain all evening and see Kitty, who glanced at him now and then and avoided his eyes. He was on the point of getting up when the princess, noticing that he was silent, addressed him. "Will you be long in Moscow? You're busy with the district council, though, aren't you, and can't be away for long?" "No, princess, I'm no longer a member of the council," he said. "I've come up for a few days." "There's something the matter with him," thought Countess Nordston, glancing at his stern, serious face. "He isn't in his old argumentative mood. But I'll draw him out. I do love making a fool of him before Kitty, and I'll do it." "Konstantin Dmitrievich," she said to him, "do explain something to me, please. You know all about such things. At home, in our village of Kaluga, all the peasants and all the women have drunk up all they possessed, and now they can't pay us any rent. What's the meaning of that? You always praise the peasants so." At that instant another lady came into the room, and Levin got up. "Excuse me, Countess, but I really know nothing about it, and can't tell you anything," he said, and looked around at the officer who came in behind the lady. "That must be Vronsky," thought Levin, and, to be sure of it, glanced at Kitty. She had already had time to look at Vronsky, and looked back at Levin. And simply from the look in her eyes, which grew unconsciously brighter, Levin knew that she loved that man, knew it as surely as if she had told him so in words. But what sort of a man was he? Now, whether for good or for ill, Levin could not choose but remain. He must find out what the man was like whom she loved. There are people who, on meeting a successful rival, no matter in what, are at once disposed to turn their backs on everything good in him and see only what is bad. There are people, on the other hand, who desire above all to find in that lucky rival the qualities by which he has outstripped them, and seek with a throbbing ache at heart only what is good. Levin belonged to the second class, but he had no difficulty in finding what was good and attractive in Vronsky. It was apparent at the first glance. Vronsky was a squarely built dark man, not very tall, with a good-humoured, handsome, and exceedingly calm, resolute face. Everything about his face and figure, from his short-cropped black hair and freshly shaven chin, down to his loosely fitting, brand-new uniform, was simple and at the same time elegant. Making way for the lady who had come in, Vronsky went up to the princess and then to Kitty. As he approached her, his beautiful eyes shone with a specially tender light, and with a faint, happy, and modestly triumphant smile, so it seemed to Levin, bowing carefully and respectfully over her, he held out his small, broad hand to her. Greeting and saying a few words to everyone, he sat down without once glancing at Levin, who had never taken his eyes off him. "Let me introduce you," said the princess, indicating Levin. "Konstantin Dmitrievich Levin, Count Alexei Kirillovich Vronsky." Vronsky got up, and looking cordially at Levin, shook hands with him. "I believe I was to have dined with you this winter," he said, smiling his simple and open smile. "But you had unexpectedly left for the country."
"Konstantin Dmitrievich despises and hates town and us townspeople," said Countess Nordston.
"My words must make a deep impression on you, since you remember them so well," said Levin. And suddenly conscious that he had said just the same thing before, he reddened. Vronsky looked at Levin and Countess Nordston and smiled.
"Are you always in the country?" he inquired. "I should think it must be dull in the winter."
"It's not dull if one has work to do. Besides, one's not bored by oneself," Levin replied curtly.
"I'm fond of the country," said Vronsky, noticing and affecting not to notice Levin's tone.
"But I hope, Count, that you would not consent to live in the country always," said Countess Nordston.
"I don't know. I've never tried for long.
I experienced a strange feeling once," he went on. "I never longed so for the country, Russian country, with bast shoes and peasants, as when I was spending a winter with my mother in Nice. Nice itself is dull enough, you know. And indeed Naples and Sorrento are pleasant only for a short time. And it's there that Russia comes back to me most vividly, and especially the country. It's as though—"
He talked on, addressing both Kitty and Levin, turning his serene, friendly eyes from one to the other, and obviously saying just what came into his head. Noticing that Countess Nordston wanted to say something, he stopped short without finishing what he had begun, and listened attentively to her. The conversation didn't flag for an instant, so that the princess, who always kept in reserve, in case a subject should be lacking, two heavy guns, the relative advantages of classical and of scientific education, and universal military service, had not to move out either of them, while Countess Nordston had not a chance of teasing Levin. Levin wanted to, and could not, take part in the general conversation, saying to himself every instant, "Now go." He still didn't go, as though waiting for something. The conversation fell upon table rapping and spirits, and Countess Nordston, who believed in spiritualism, began to describe the marvel she had seen.
"Ah, Countess, you really must take me, for pity's sake. Do take me to see them. I've never seen anything extraordinary, though I'm always on the lookout for it everywhere," said Vronsky, smiling.
"Very well, next Saturday," answered Countess Nordston. "But you, Konstantin Dmitrievich, do you believe in it?" she asked Levin.
"Why do you ask me? You know what I shall say."
"But I want to hear your opinion."
"My opinion," answered Levin, "is only that this table-rapping simply proves that educated society, so-called, is no higher than the peasants. They believe in the evil eye and in witchcraft and omens, while we—"
"Oh! Then you don't believe in it?"
"I can't believe in it, Countess."
"But if I've seen it myself?"
The
Peasant women, too, tell us they have seen goblins.
Then you think I tell a lie?
And she laughed a mirthless laugh.
Oh, no, Masha. Konstantin Dmitrievich said he couldn't believe in it, said Kitty, blushing for Levin.
And Levin saw this, and still more exasperated would have answered. But Vronsky, with his bright, frank smile, rushed to the support of the conversation, which was threatening to become disagreeable.
"You don't admit the conceivability at all?"
he queried.
"But why not? We admit the existence of electricity, of which we know nothing. Why should there not be some new force still unknown to us which—" "When electricity was discovered,"
Levin interrupted hurriedly. "It was only the phenomenon that was discovered, and it was unknown from what it proceeded and what were its effects, and ages passed before its applications were conceived. But the spiritualists have begun with tables writing for them and spirits appearing to them, and have only later started saying that it is an unknown force." Vronsky listened attentively to Levin, as he always did listen, obviously interested in his words.
"Yes, but the spiritualists say we don't know at present what this force is. But there is a force, and these are the conditions in which it acts. Let the scientific men find out what the force consists of. No, I don't see why there shouldn't be a new force if it—"
"Why, because with electricity," Levin interrupted again, "every time you rub resin against wool, a recognized phenomenon is manifested. But in this case it doesn't happen every time, and so it follows it is not a natural phenomenon." Feeling probably that the conversation was taking a tone too serious for a drawing room, Vronsky made no rejoinder, but by way of trying to change the conversation, he smiled brightly and turned to the ladies.
"Do let us try it once, Countess," he said.
But Levin wanted to finish saying what he thought.
"I think," he went on, "that this attempt of the spiritualists to explain their marvels as some sort of new natural force is most futile. They boldly talk of spiritual force and then try to subject it to material experiment."
Everyone was waiting for him to finish, and he felt it.
"And I think you would be a first-rate medium," said Countess Nordston. "There's something enthusiastic in you."
Levin opened his mouth, was about to say something, reddened, and said nothing.
"Do let us try table rapping at once, please," said Vronsky. "Princess, will you allow it?"
And Vronsky stood up, looking about for a little table. Kitty got up to fetch a table, and as she passed, her eyes met Levin's. She felt for him with her whole heart, the more because she was pitying him for suffering from the pain she had caused. "If you can, forgive me," said her eyes. "I'm so happy."
"I hate them all, and you, and myself," his eyes responded, and he picked up his hat. But he was not destined to escape. Just as they were arranging themselves around the table, and Levin was on the point of leaving, the old prince came in, and after greeting the ladies, addressed Levin.
"Ah," he began joyously, "been here long, me boy? I didn't even know you were in town. Very glad to see you."
In addressing Levin, the prince sometimes used thou and sometimes you. The old prince embraced Levin, and talking to him, didn't observe Vronsky, who had risen and was quietly waiting till the prince should turn to him. Kitty felt how distasteful her father's warmth was to Levin after what had happened. She saw, too, how coldly her father responded at last to Vronsky's bow, and how Vronsky looked with amiable bewilderment at her father, as though trying and failing to understand how and why anyone could be hostilely disposed towards him, and she flushed.
"Prince, let us have Konstantin Dmitrievich," said Countess Nordston. "We want to try an experiment."
"What experiment?" "Table rapping. Well, you must excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, but to my mind it's better fun to play the ring game," said the old prince, looking at Vronsky and guessing that it had been his suggestion. "There's some sense in that, anyway."
Vronsky looked wonderingly at the prince with his resolute eyes, and with a faint smile, began immediately talking to Countess Nordston of the great ball that was to come off next week.
"I hope you will be there," he said to Kitty.
As soon as the old prince turned away from him, Levin went out unnoticed, and the last impression he carried away with him of that evening was the smiling, happy face of Kitty answering Vronsky's inquiry about the ball. Chapter 15. At the end of the evening, Kitty told her mother of her conversation with Levin, and in spite of all the pity she felt for Levin, she was glad at the thought that she had received a proposal. She had no doubt that she had acted properly. But after she had gone to bed, for a long while she couldn't sleep. One impression pursued her relentlessly. It was Levin's face with his scowling brows and his kind eyes looking out in dark dejection below them as he stood listening to her father and glancing at her and at Vronsky. And she felt so sorry for him that tears came into her eyes. But immediately she thought of the man for whom she had given him up. She vividly recalled his manly, resolute face, his noble self-possession, and the good nature conspicuous in everything he did toward everyone. She remembered the love for her of the man she loved, and once more all was gladness in her soul, and she lay on the pillow smiling with happiness. "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, but what could I do? It's not my fault," she said to herself. But an inner voice told her something else. Whether she felt remorse at having won Levin's love or at having refused him, she didn't know. But her happiness was poisoned by doubts. "Lord, have mercy on us. Lord, have mercy on us. Lord, have mercy on us," she repeated to herself till she fell asleep. Meanwhile, below, in the prince's little library, there occurred one of the scenes so often repeated between the parents on account of their favourite daughter. "But really, for mercy's sake, prince, what have I done?" said the princess, almost crying.
"What? I'll tell you what," shouted the prince, waving his arms and wrapping his squirrel-lined dressing-gown round him again. "You've no pride, no dignity. You're disgracing, ruining your daughter by this vulgar, stupid matchmaking."
She, pleased and happy after her conversation with her daughter, had gone to the prince to say good night as usual, and though she had no intention of telling him of Levin's offer and Kitty's refusal, still she hinted to her husband that she thought things were practically settled with Vronsky, and that he would declare himself as soon as his mother arrived. And thereupon, at those words, the prince had all at once flown into a passion and begun to use unpleasant language.
"What have you done? I'll tell you what. First of all, you're trying to catch an eligible gentleman, and all Moscow will be talking of it, and with good reason. If you have evening parties, invite everyone. Don't pick out just the possible suitors. Invite all the young bucks,"
which is what the prince called Moscow's young men.
"Engage a piano player and let them dance, and not as you've been doing things, hunting up good matches. It makes me sick, sick to see it. And you've gone on till you've turned the poor girl's head. Levin's a thousand times the better man. As for this little Petersburg dandy, they're turned out by machinery, all on one pattern and all precious rubbish. But even if he were a prince of the blood, my daughter needn't run after anyone."
"But what have I done?
Why, you've..."
the prince cried wrathfully.
"I know if one were to listen to you," the princess interrupted, "we would never marry our daughter. If it's to be so, we'd better go into the country." "Well, we'd better."
"But do wait a minute. Do I try and catch them? I don't try to catch them in the least. A young man, and a very nice one, has fallen in love with her, and she, I imagine..."
"Oh, yes, you imagine. And what if she really is in love, and he's no more thinking of marriage than I am? Oh, that I should live to see it. Ah, spiritualism. Ah, niece. Ah, the ball."
And the prince, imagining that he was mimicking his wife, made a mincing curtsy at each word.
"And this is how we're preparing wretchedness for Katya, and she's really got the notion into her head."
"But what makes you suppose so?"
"I don't suppose, I know. We have eyes for such things, though women haven't. I see a man who has serious intentions, that's Levin. And I see a peacock, like this featherhead, who's only amusing himself."
"Oh, well, when once you get an idea into your head.
Well, you'll remember my words, but too late. Just as with Dolly.
Well, we won't talk of it, the princess said quickly, recollecting her unlucky Dolly.
By all means. And good night.
And making the sign of the cross over each other, the husband and wife parted with a kiss, feeling that they each remained of their own opinion. The princess had at first been quite certain that that evening had settled Kitty's future, and that there could be no doubt of Vronsky's intentions. But her husband's words had disturbed her, and returning to her own room, in terror before the unknown future, she too, like Kitty, repeated several times in her heart, "Lord, have mercy on us." Chapter 16. Vronsky had never had a real family life. His mother had been in her youth a brilliant society woman who had had during her married life, and especially afterward, many love affairs notorious in all society. His father he scarcely remembered, and he had been educated in the Corps of Pages. Leaving the school very young as a brilliant officer, he had at once got into the circle of wealthy Petersburg military men. Although he did go more or less into Petersburg society, his love affairs had always hitherto been outside it. In Moscow he had for the first time felt, after his luxurious and coarse life at Petersburg, all the charm of intimacy with a sweet and innocent girl of his own rank who cared for him. It never even entered his head that there could be any harm in his relations with Kitty. At balls he danced mostly with her. He was a constant visitor at their house. He talked to her as people commonly do talk in society, all sorts of nonsense, but nonsense to which he couldn't help attaching a special meaning in her case. Although he said nothing to her that he could not have said before everybody, he felt that she was becoming more and more dependent upon him, and the more he felt this, the better he liked it, and the tenderer was his feeling for her. He didn't know that this mode of behaviour in relation to Kitty had a definite character, that is, courting young girls with no intention of marriage, and that such courting is one of the evil actions common among brilliant young men such as he was. It seemed to him that he was the first who had discovered this pleasure, and he was enjoying his discovery. If he could have heard what her parents were saying that evening, if he could have put himself in the position of her family, and have heard that Kitty would be unhappy if he didn't marry her, he would have been greatly astonished, and wouldn't have believed it. He couldn't believe that what gave such great and delicate pleasure to him, and above all to her, could be wrong. Still less could he have believed that he ought to marry. Marriage had never presented itself to him as a possibility. He disliked not only family life, but a family, and especially to be a husband, was, in accordance with the views general in the bachelor world in which he lived, conceived as something alien, repellent, and above all, absurd. But though Vronsky hadn't the least suspicion what the parents were saying, he felt, on coming away from the Shushchabatskys, that the secret spiritual bond which existed between him and Kitty had grown so much stronger that evening that some step must be taken. But what step could and ought to be taken, he couldn't imagine. "What is so exquisite," he thought, as he returned from the Shushchabatskys, carrying away with him, as he always did, a delicious feeling of purity and freshness, arising partly from the fact that he hadn't smoked for a whole evening, and with it a new feeling of tenderness at her love for him. "What is so exquisite is that not a word has been said by me or by her, but we understand each other so well in this unseen language of looks and tones, that this evening, more clearly than ever, she told me she loves me. And how secretly, simply, and most of all, how trustfully. I feel myself better, purer. I feel that I have a heart, and that there is a great deal of good in me. Those sweet, loving eyes. When she said, 'Indeed I do.'
Well, what then? Oh, nothing. It's good for me and good for her."
And he began wondering where to finish the evening. He thought of the places he might go. The club? A game of bezique? Champagne with Ignatov?
No, I'm not going. Chateau des Fleurs, where I'll find Oblonsky, songs the can-can? No, I'm sick of it. That's why I like the Shishchabatskys, because I become better there. I'll go home. He went straight to his room at Dussert's, ordered supper, and then undressed, and as soon as his head touched the pillow, he fell into a sound sleep. Chapter 17. The next day, at 11 o'clock in the morning, Vronsky drove to the station of the Petersburg Railway to meet his mother, and the first person he came across on the great flight of steps was Oblonsky, who was expecting his sister by the same train.
"Ah, Your Excellency!" cried Oblonsky. "Whom are you meeting?"
"My mother," Vronsky responded, smiling, as everyone did who met Oblonsky. He shook hands with him, and together they ascended the steps.
"She's coming here from Petersburg today." "I was looking for you till 2 o'clock last night. Where did you go after the Shishchabatskys?"
"Home," answered Vronsky.
"I must admit I felt so very content yesterday after the Shishchabatskys that I didn't care to go anywhere." "I recognize the lively steeds by their brands, and I recognize young lovers by their eyes," declaimed Stepan Arkadyevitch, just as he had done before to Levin.
Vronsky smiled with a look that seemed to say that he didn't deny it, but he promptly changed the subject.
"And whom are you meeting?" he asked.
"I? I've come to meet a pretty woman," said Oblonsky.
"You don't say so."
"Annie Swarky Malipons, my sister Anna."
"Ah, that's Madame Karenina," said Vronsky.
"You know her, no doubt."
"I think I do, or perhaps not. I'm really not sure," Vronsky answered absent-mindedly, with a vague recollection of something stiff and tedious evoked by the name Karenina.
"But Alexei Alexandrovitch, my celebrated brother-in-law, you surely must know. All the world knows him."
"I know him by reputation and by sight. I know that he's clever, learned, mystical somewhat. But you know that's not in my line," said Vronsky in English.
"Yes, he's a very remarkable man, rather a conservative, but a splendid man," Stepan Arkadyevitch observed. "A splendid man."
"Oh, well, so much the better for him," said Vronsky, smiling.
"Oh, you've come," he said, addressing a tall old footman of his mother's standing at the door. "Come here."
Besides the charm Oblonsky had in general for everyone, Vronsky had felt of late especially drawn to him by the fact that in his imagination he was associated with Kitty.
"Well, what do you say? Shall we give a supper on Sunday for the diva?" he said to him with a smile, taking his arm.
"Of course. I'm making a collection."
"Oh, did you make the acquaintance of my friend Levin?" asked Stepan Arkadyevitch.
"Yes, but he left rather early."
"He's a fine fellow," Oblonsky said, "isn't he?"
"I don't know why it is," Vronsky responded. "In all Moscow, people, present company of course excepted," he put in jestingly, "there's something uncompromising. They're all on the defensive, lose their tempers, as though they all want to make one feel something."
"Yes, that's true. It is so," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, laughing good-humouredly.
"Will the train be in soon?" Vronsky asked a railway official.
"The train's signalled," answered the man.
The approach of the train was more and more evident by the preparatory bustle in the station, the rush of porters, the movement of policemen and attendants, and people meeting the train. Through the frosty vapour could be seen workmen in short sheepskins and soft felt boots crossing the rails of the curving line. The hiss of the boiler could be heard on the distant rails, and the rumble of something heavy.
"No," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, who felt a great inclination to tell Vronsky of Levin's intentions in regard to Kitty.
"No, you've not got a true impression of Levin. He's a very nervous man, and is sometimes out of humour, it's true, but then he is often very nice. He has such a true, honest nature and a heart of gold. But yesterday there were special reasons," Stepan Arkadyevitch said with a meaningful smile, totally oblivious of the genuine sympathy he had felt the day before for his friend, and feeling the same sympathy now only for Vronsky.
Yes, there were reasons why he couldn't help being either particularly happy or particularly unhappy.
Vronsky stood still and asked directly, "How so? Do you mean he made your belle sœur a proposal yesterday?"
"Maybe," said Stepan Arkadyevitch. "I thought something of the sort yesterday. Yes, if he went away early and was out of humour too, it must mean it... He's been in love so long, and I'm very sorry for him."
"So that's it."
"I should imagine, though, that she could expect a better match," said Vronsky, drawing himself up and walking about again. "Though I don't know him, of course," he added. "Yes, that's a painful position.
That's why most fellows prefer our tarts. If you don't succeed with them, it only proves that you've not enough cash. But in this case, one's dignity is at stake.
But here's the train."
The engine had already whistled in the distance. A few instants later, the platform was quivering, and with puffs of steam hanging low in the air from the frost, the engine rolled up, with the lever of the middle wheel rhythmically moving up and down, and the stooped, muffled figure of the engine driver covered with frost. Behind the tender, setting the platform more and more slowly swaying, came the luggage van with a dog whining in it. At last the passenger cars rolled in, jolting as they came to a standstill. A dashing guard jumped out, giving a whistle, and after him, one by one, the impatient passengers began to get down. An officer of the guards, holding himself erect and looking severely about him, a nimble little merchant with a satchel, smiling gaily, a peasant with a sack over his shoulder. Vronsky, standing beside Oblonsky, watched the carriages and the passengers, totally oblivious of his mother. What he had just heard about Kitty excited and delighted him. Unconsciously, he squared his shoulders and his eyes flashed. He felt himself a conqueror.
"Countess Vronsky is in that compartment," said the dashing guard, going up to Vronsky.
The guard's words roused him and forced him to think of his mother and his approaching meeting with her. He didn't in his heart respect his mother, and without acknowledging it to himself, he didn't love her, though in accordance with the ideas of the set in which he lived and with his own education, he could not have conceived of any behaviour to his mother not in the highest degree respectful and obedient. And the more externally obedient and respectful his behaviour, the less in his heart he respected and loved her. Chapter 18. Vronsky followed the guard to the carriage, and at the door of the compartment he stopped short to make room for a lady who was getting out. With the insight of a man of the world, from one glance at this lady's appearance, Vronsky classified her as belonging to the best society. He excused himself, and was about to get into the carriage, but felt he must glance at her once more, not because she was very beautiful, not because of the elegance and modest grace that were apparent in her whole figure, but because in the expression of her charming face, as she passed close by him, there was something peculiarly caressing and soft. As he looked around, she too turned her head. Her shining grey eyes, which looked dark from the thick lashes, rested with friendly attention on his face, as though she recognised him, and then promptly turned away to the passing crowd, as though seeking someone. In that brief look, Vronsky had time to notice the suppressed eagerness which played over her face and flitted between the brilliant eyes and the faint smile that curved her red lips. It was as though her nature was so brimming over with something that against her will it showed itself, now in the flash of her eyes and now in her smile. Deliberately she shrouded the light in her eyes, but it shone against her will in the faintly perceptible smile. Vronsky stepped into the carriage. His mother, a dried-up old lady with black eyes and ringlets, screwed up her eyes, scanning her son, and smiled slightly with her thin lips. Getting up from the seat and handing her maid a bag, she gave her little wrinkled hand to her son to kiss, and lifting his head from her hand, kissed him on the cheek.
"You got my telegram? Quite well? Thank God."
"You had a good journey," said her son, sitting down beside her, and involuntarily listening to a woman's voice outside the door. He knew it was the voice of the lady he had met at the door.
"All the same, I don't agree with you," said the lady's voice. "It's the Petersburg view, madame."
"Not Petersburg, but simply feminine," she responded.
"Well, well, allow me to kiss your hand. Goodbye, Ivan Petrovich."
"And would you see if my brother is here and send him to me?" said the lady in the doorway, and stepped back again into the compartment.
"Well, have you found your brother?"
asked Countess Vronsky, addressing the lady.
Vronsky understood now that this was Madame Karenina.
"Your brother is here," he said, standing up. "Excuse me, I didn't know you, and indeed our acquaintance was so slight," said Vronsky, bowing, "that no doubt you do not remember me."
"Oh, no," said she.
"I would have known you, because your mother and I have been talking, I think, of nothing but you all the way."
As she spoke, she let the eagerness that would insist on coming out show itself in her smile.
"And still no sign of my brother."
"Do call him, Aloysia," said the old countess.
Vronsky stepped out onto the platform and shouted,
"Oblonsky, here!"
Madame Karenina, however, didn't wait for her brother, but catching sight of him, stepped out with her light, determined step. And as soon as her brother had reached her, she flung her left arm round his neck, drew him rapidly to her, and kissed him warmly with a gesture that struck Vronsky by its decision and its grace. Vronsky gazed, never taking his eyes from her, and smiled. He couldn't have said why. But recollecting that his mother was waiting for him, he went back again into the carriage.
"She's very sweet, isn't she?"
said the Countess of Madame Karenina.
"Her husband put her with me, and I was delighted to have her. We've been talking all the way. And so you, I hear, vous filez le parfait amour? Tant mieux, mon cher, tant mieux?"
"I don't know what you're referring to, maman," he answered coldly.
"Come, maman, let's go."
Madame Karenina entered the carriage again to say goodbye to the Countess.
"Well, Countess, you have met your son and I my brother," she said, "and all my gossip is exhausted. I would have nothing more to tell you."
"Oh, no," said the Countess, taking her hand. "I could go all around the world with you and never be bored. You're one of those delightful women in whose company it's sweet to be silent as well as to talk. Now, please don't fret over your son. You can't expect never to be parted."
Madame Karenina stood quite still, holding herself very erect, and her eyes were smiling.
"Anna Arkadyevna," the Countess said in explanation to her son, "has a little son, 8 years old, I believe, and she has never been parted from him before, and she keeps worrying over leaving him."
"Yes.
The Countess and I have been talking all the time, I of my son, and she of hers," said Madame Karenina, and again a smile lighted up her face, a caressing smile intended for him.
"I'm afraid that you must have been dreadfully bored," he said, promptly catching the ball of coquetry that she had flung him.
But apparently she didn't care to pursue the conversation in that strain, and she turned to the old Countess.
"Thank you so much. The time has passed so quickly. Goodbye, Countess."
"Goodbye, darling," answered the Countess. "Let me have a kiss of your pretty face. I speak plainly at my age, and I tell you simply that I've lost my heart to you."
Stereotyped as the phrase was, Madame Karenina obviously believed it and was delighted by it. She flushed, bent down slightly, and put her cheek to the Countess's lips, drew herself up again, and with the same smile fluttering between her lips and her eyes, she gave her hand to Vronsky. He pressed the little hand she gave him, and was delighted, as though at something special, by the energetic squeeze with which she freely and vigorously shook his hand. She went out with the rapid step that bore her rather fully developed figure with such strange lightness.
"Very charming," said the Countess.
That was just what her son was thinking. His eyes followed her till her graceful figure was out of sight, and then the smile remained on his face. He saw out of the window how she went up to her brother, put her arm in his, and began telling him something eagerly. Obviously something that had nothing to do with him, Vronsky, and at that he felt annoyed.
"Well, maman, are you perfectly well?"
he repeated, turning to his mother.
"Everything has been delightful. Alexander has been very good, and Marie has grown very pretty. She is very interesting."
And she began telling him again of what interested her most, the christening of her grandson, for which she had been staying in Petersburg, and the special favour shown her elder son by the Tsar.
"Here's Lavrentiy," said Vronsky, looking out of the window. "Now we can go, if you like."
The old butler, who had travelled with the Countess, came to the carriage to announce that everything was ready, and the Countess got up to go.
"Come, there's not such a crowd now," said Vronsky. The maid took a bag and the lapdog, the butler and a porter the other luggage.
Vronsky gave his mother his arm, but just as they were getting out of the carriage, several men suddenly ran by with panic-stricken faces. The station master, too, ran by in his extraordinary coloured cap. Obviously something unusual had happened. The crowd, who had left the train, was running back again.
"What?
Where? Where?" "Flung himself. Crushed," was heard among the crowd. Stepan Arkadyevitch, with his sister on his arm, turned back. They too looked scared and stopped at the carriage door to avoid the crowd. The ladies got in, while Vronsky and Stepan Arkadyevitch followed the crowd to find out details of the disaster. A guard, either drunk or too much muffled up in the bitter frost, hadn't heard the train moving back and had been crushed. Before Vronsky and Oblonsky came back, the ladies heard the facts from the butler. Oblonsky and Vronsky had both seen the mutilated corpse. Oblonsky was evidently upset. He frowned and seemed ready to cry.
"Oh, how awful! Oh, Anna, if you had seen it! Oh, how awful!" he said.
Vronsky didn't speak. His handsome face was serious but perfectly composed.
"Oh, if you had seen it, Countess," said Stepan Arkadyevitch. "And his wife was there. It was awful to see her. She flung herself on the body. They say he was the only support of an immense family. How awful!"
"Couldn't one do anything for her?" said Madame Karenina in an agitated whisper.
Vronsky glanced at her and immediately got out of the carriage.
"I'll be back directly, maman," he remarked, turning round in the doorway.
When he came back a few minutes later, Stepan Arkadyevitch was already in conversation with the Countess about the new singer, while the Countess was impatiently looking toward the door, waiting for her son.
"Now, let us be off," said Vronsky, coming in.
They went out together. Vronsky was in front with his mother. Behind walked Madame Karenina with her brother. Just as they were going out of the station, the station master overtook Vronsky.
"You gave my assistant 200 rubles. Would you kindly explain for whose benefit you intend them?"
"For the widow," said Vronsky, shrugging his shoulder. "I should have thought there was no need to ask."
"You gave that?" cried Oblonsky from behind, and pressing his sister's hand, he added, "Very nice, very nice. Isn't he a splendid fellow? Goodbye, Countess."
And he and his sister stood still, looking for her maid. When they went out, the Vronsky's carriage had already driven away. People coming in were still talking of what had happened.
"What a horrible death," said a gentleman passing by. "They say he was cut in two pieces." "On the contrary, I think it's the easiest. Instantaneous," observed another.
"How is it they don't take proper precautions?" said a third.
Madame Karenina seated herself in the carriage, and Stepan Arkadyevitch saw with surprise that her lips were quivering, and she was with difficulty restraining her tears.
"What is it, Anna?" he asked when they had driven several hundred yards. "It's an evil omen," she said.
"What nonsense!" said Stepan Arkadyevitch. "You've come, that's the main thing. You can't conceive how I'm resting my hopes on you."
"Have you known Vronsky long?" she asked.
"Yes.
You know we're hoping he'll marry Kitty."
"Yes," said Anna softly.
"Come now, let's talk of you," she added, tossing her head, as though she would physically shake off something superfluous oppressing her.
Let us talk of your affairs.
I got your letter, and here I am.
Yes, all my hopes are in you, said Stepan Arkadyevitch.
Well, tell me all about it.
And Stepan Arkadyevitch began to tell his story. On reaching home, Oblonsky helped his sister out, sighed, pressed her hand, and went off to his office.
Chapter 19. When Anna went into the room, Dolly was sitting in the little drawing-room with a light-haired, chubby little boy, who already resembled his father, giving him a lesson in French reading. As the boy read, he kept twisting and trying to tear off a button that was nearly off his jacket. His mother had several times taken his hand from it, but the fat little hand went back to the button again. His mother pulled the button off and put it in her pocket. "Keep your hand still, Grisha," she said, and she took up her work, a blanket that she had long been making. She always began to work on it at depressed moments, and now she knitted at it nervously, twitching her fingers and counting the stitches. Though she had sent word the day before to her husband that it was nothing to her whether his sister came or not, she had made everything ready for her arrival and was expecting her sister-in-law anxiously. Dolly was crushed by her sorrow, utterly swallowed up by it. Still, she didn't forget that Anna, her sister-in-law, was the wife of one of the most important personages in Petersburg, and was a Petersburg grande dame. And, thanks to this circumstance, she didn't carry out her threat to her husband. That is to say, she remembered that her sister-in-law was coming. "And after all, Anna is in no way to blame," thought Dolly. "I know nothing of her except the very best, and I have seen nothing but kindness and affection from her towards myself." It was true that, as far as she could recall, her impressions in Petersburg at the Karenins. She didn't like their household itself. There was something artificial in the whole framework of their family life. "But why should I not receive her? If only she doesn't take it into her head to console me," thought Dolly. "All consolation and counsel and Christian forgiveness, all that I have thought over 1,000 times, and it's all no use." All these days Dolly had been alone with her children. She didn't want to talk of her sorrow, but with that sorrow in her heart, she couldn't talk of outside matters. She knew that in one way or another she would tell Anna everything, and she was alternately glad at the thought of speaking freely, and angry at the necessity of speaking of her humiliation with her, his sister, and of hearing her ready-made phrases of good advice and comfort. She had been on the lookout for her, glancing at her watch every minute, and, as often happens, let slip just that minute when her visitor arrived, so that she didn't hear the bell. Catching a sound of skirts and light steps at the door, she looked around, and her careworn face unconsciously expressed not gladness, but wonder. She got up and embraced her sister-in-law. "What, here already?" she said as she kissed her. "Dolly, how glad I am to see you." "I'm glad too," said Dolly, faintly smiling and trying by the expression of Anna's face to find out whether she knew. "Most likely she knows," she thought, noticing the sympathy in Anna's face. "Well, come along. I'll take you to your room," she went on, trying to defer as long as possible the moment of confidences. "Is this Grisha? Heavens, how he's grown," said Anna, and kissing him, never taking her eyes off Dolly, she stood still and flushed a little. "No, please, let's stay here." She took off her kerchief and her hat, and catching it in a lock of her black hair, which was a mass of curls, she tossed her head and shook her hair down. "You're radiant with health and happiness," said Dolly, almost with envy.
"I?"
"Yes," said Anna.
"Merciful heavens, Tanya, you're the same age as my Seryozha," she added, addressing the little girl as she ran in. She took her in her arms and kissed her. "Delightful child, delightful. Show me them all."
She mentioned them, remembering not only the names, but also the years, months, characters and illnesses of all the children, and Dolly could not but appreciate that.
"Very well, we will go to them," she said. "It's a pity Vasha's asleep."
After seeing the children, they sat down, alone now in the drawing-room, to coffee. Anna took the tray and then pushed it away from her. "Dolly," she said,
He has told me.
Dolly looked coldly at Anna. She was waiting now for phrases of conventional sympathy. But Anna said nothing of the sort.
Dolly, dear, she said, I don't want to speak of him or try to comfort you. That's impossible. But, darling, I'm simply sorry, sorry from my heart for you.
Under the thick lashes of her shining eyes, tears suddenly glittered. She moved nearer to her sister-in-law and took her hand in her vigorous little hand. Dolly didn't shrink away, but her face didn't lose its frigid expression. She said,
To comfort me is impossible. Everything's lost after what has happened. Everything's over.
And as soon as she had said this, her face suddenly softened. Anna lifted the wasted, thin hand of Dolly, kissed it, and said,
But, Dolly, what's to be done? What's to be done? How is it best to act in this awful situation? That's what you must think of.
All's over, and there's nothing more, said Dolly. And the worst of it is, you see, that I can't cast him off. There are the children. I'm tied. And I can't live with him. It's torture to see him.
Dolly, darling, he has spoken to me, but I want to hear it from you. Tell me all about it.
Dolly looked at her inquiringly. Sympathy and sincere love were visible on Anna's face.
Very well, she said at once. But I will tell it from the beginning. You know how I was married. With the education Mama gave us, I was more than innocent. I was stupid. I knew nothing. I know they say men tell their wives of their former lives, but Stiva... She corrected herself. Stepan Arkadyevich told me nothing. You'll hardly believe it, but till now I imagined that I was the only woman he had known. So I lived 8 years. You must understand that I was so far from suspecting infidelity. I regarded it as impossible, and then... Try to imagine it, with such ideas to find out suddenly all the horror, all the loathsomeness. You must try and understand me. To be fully convinced of one's happiness and all at once, continued Dolly, holding back her sobs. To get a letter, his letter to his mistress, my governess. No, it's too awful. She hastily pulled out her handkerchief and hid her face in it. I can understand being carried away by feeling, she went on after a brief silence. But deliberately, slyly deceiving me, and with whom? To go on being my husband together with her. Oh, it's awful. You can't understand.
Oh, yes, I understand. I understand, Dolly, dearest. I do understand, said Anna, pressing her hand.
And do you think he realizes the horror of my position? Dolly resumed. Not the slightest. He's happy and contented.
Oh, no, Anna interposed quickly. He's to be pitied. He's weighed down by remorse.
Is he capable of remorse? Dolly interrupted, gazing intently into her sister-in-law's face.
Yes, I know him. I couldn't look at him without feeling sorry for him. We both know him. He's good-hearted, but he's proud. And now he's so humiliated. What touched me most? And here Anna guessed what would touch Dolly most. He's tortured by two things, that he's ashamed for the children's sake, and that loving you, yes, yes, loving you, beyond everything on earth, she hurriedly interrupted Dolly, who would have answered. He has hurt you, pierced you to the heart.
No, no, she cannot forgive me, he keeps saying.
Dolly looked dreamily away beyond her sister-in-law as she listened to her words.
Yes, I can see that his position is awful. It's worse for the guilty than the innocent, she said, if he feels that all the misery is his fault.
But how am I to forgive him? How am I to be his wife again after her?
For me to live with him now would be torture, just because I love my past love for him.
And sobs cut short her words. But as though intentionally, each time she was softened, she began to speak again of what exasperated her.
She's young, you see. She's pretty, she went on.
Do you know, Anna, my youth and my beauty are gone.
Taken by whom? By him and his children.
I've worked for him, and all I had has gone in his service.
And now, of course, any fresh, vulgar creature has more charm for him.
No doubt they talked of me together, or worse still, they were silent. Do you understand?
Again, her eyes glowed with hatred. And after that, he will tell me.
What? Can I believe him? Never.
No, everything is over.
Everything that once made my comfort, the reward of my work and my sufferings.
Would you believe it?
I was teaching Grisha just now.
Once this was a joy to me.
Now it's a torture. What have I to strive and toil for? Why are the children here? What's so dreadful is that all at once my heart's revolted. And instead of love and tenderness, I have nothing but hatred for him. Yes, hatred. I could kill him.
Darling Dolly, I understand. But don't torture yourself. You are so distressed, so overwrought, that you look at many things mistakenly.
Dolly grew calmer, and for 2 minutes both were silent.
What's to be done? Think for me, Anna, help me. I've thought over everything, and I see nothing.
Anna could think of nothing, but her heart responded instantly to each word, to each change of expression of her sister-in-law.
"One thing I would say," began Anna. "I am his sister.
I know his character, that faculty of forgetting everything. Everything!"
She waved her hand before her forehead.
"That faculty for being completely carried away, but for completely repenting, too. He cannot believe it. He cannot comprehend now how he can have acted as he did.
No, he understands.
He understood,"
Dolly broke in.
"But I... You're forgetting me. Does it make it easier for me?"
Wait a minute.
When he told me, I will admit I didn't realize the full horror of your position. I saw nothing but him, and that the family was broken up. I felt sorry for him. But after talking to you, I see it as a woman quite differently. I see your agony, and I can't tell you how sorry I am for you.
But Dolly, darling, I fully realize your sufferings.
Only there is one thing I don't know. I don't know how much love there is still in your heart for him. That you know, whether there is enough for you to be able to forgive him.
If there is, forgive him.
No, Dolly was beginning.
But Anna cut her short, kissing her hand once more.
I know more of the world than you do, she said. I know how men like Steva look at it.
You speak of his talking of you with her. That never happened. Such men are unfaithful, but their own home and wife are sacred to them. Somehow or other, these women are still looked on with contempt by them, and do not touch on their feeling for their family. They draw a sort of line that can't be crossed between them and their families. I don't understand it, but it is so.
Yes, but he has kissed her.
Dolly, hush, darling.
I saw Steva when he was in love with you. I remember the time when he came to me and cried, talking of you and all the poetry and loftiness of his feeling for you. And I know that the longer he has lived with you, the loftier you have been in his eyes. You know, we have sometimes laughed at him for putting in at every word, Dolly's a marvellous woman. You've always been a divinity for him. And you are that still. And this has not been an infidelity of the heart.
But if it is repeated?
It cannot be, as I understand it.
Yes. But could you forgive it?
I don't know. I can't judge.
Yes, I can, said Anna, thinking a moment and grasping the position in her thought and weighing it in her mind, she added, Yes, I can. I can, yes. I could forgive it. I couldn't be the same, no. But I could forgive it, and forgive it as though it had never been at all.
Oh, of course,
Dolly interposed quickly, as though saying what she had more than once thought.
Else it would not be forgiveness.
If one forgives, it must be completely, completely.
Come, let us go. I'll take you to your room, she said, getting up, and on the way she embraced Anna. My dear, how glad I am you came. It's made things better. So very much better.
Chapter 20. The whole of that day Anna spent at home, that is to say, at the Oblonskys, and received no one, though some of her acquaintances had already heard of her arrival and came to see her. Anna spent the whole morning with Dolly and the children. She merely sent a brief note to her brother to tell him that he must not fail to dine at home.
"Come, God is merciful," she wrote.
Oblonsky did dine at home. The conversation was general, and his wife, speaking to him, addressed him as Stiva, as she hadn't done before. In the relations of the husband and wife, the same estrangement still remained, but there was no talk now of separation, and Stepan Arkadyevitch saw the possibility of explanation and reconciliation. Immediately after dinner, Kitty came. She knew Anna, but only very slightly, and she came now to her sisters with some trepidation at the prospect of meeting this fashionable Petersburg lady, whom everyone spoke so highly of. But she made a favourable impression on Anna. She saw that at once. Anna was unmistakably struck by her loveliness and her youth, and before Kitty knew where she was, she found herself not merely under Anna's influence, but in love with her, as young girls do fall in love with older and married women. Anna was not like a fashionable lady, nor the mother of a boy 8 years old. In the elasticity of her movements, the freshness and the unflagging eagerness which persisted in her face and broke out in her smile and her glance, she would have passed for a girl of 20, had it not been for a serious and at times mournful look in her eyes, which struck and attracted Kitty. Kitty felt that Anna was perfectly natural and was concealing nothing, but that she had another higher world of interests inaccessible to her, complex and poetic. After dinner, when Dolly went away to her own room, Anna rose quickly and went up to her brother, who was just lighting a cigar.
"Stiva," she said to him, winking gaily, making the sign of the cross over him, and glancing toward the door, "go, and God help you."
He threw down the cigar, understanding her, and departed through the doorway. When Stepan Arkadyevitch had disappeared, she went back to the sofa where she was sitting, surrounded by the children. Either because the children saw that their mother was fond of this aunt, or that they felt a special charm in her themselves, the two elder ones, and the younger following their lead, as children so often do, had clung about their new aunt since before dinner, and wouldn't leave her side. And it had become a sort of game among them to sit as close as possible to her, to touch her, hold her little hand, kiss it, play with her ring, or at least touch the ruffles of her skirt.
"Come, come, as we were sitting before," said Anna, sitting down in her place.
And again Grisha poked his little face under her arm, and nestled with his head on her gown, beaming with pride and happiness.
"And when is your next ball?" she asked Kitty. "Next week, and a splendid ball. One of those balls where one always enjoys oneself."
"Why, are there balls where one always enjoys oneself?" Anna said with tender irony.
"It's strange, but there are. At the Bobrischevs, one always enjoys oneself. And at the Nikitins, too. While at the Mezhkovs, it's always dull. Haven't you noticed it?"
"No, my dear. For me, there are no balls now where one enjoys oneself," said Anna.
And Kitty detected in her eyes that mysterious world which was not open to her. "For me, there are some less boring and tiresome."
"How can you be bored at a ball?"
"Why should I not be bored at a ball?" inquired Anna.
Kitty perceived that Anna knew what answer would follow.
"Because you always look better than anyone."
Anna had the faculty of blushing. She blushed a little and said, "In the first place, it's never so, and secondly, if it were, what difference would it make to me?"
"Are you coming to this ball?" asked Kitty.
"I imagine it won't be possible to avoid going."
"Here, take it," she said to Tanya, who was pulling the loose-fitting ring off her white, slender-tipped finger. "I shall be so glad if you go. I should so like to see you at a ball."
"Anyway, if I do go, I shall comfort myself with the thought that it's a pleasure to you." "Grisha, don't pull my hair. It's untidy enough without that," she said, putting up a straying lock that Grisha had been playing with.
"I imagine you at the ball in lilac."
"And why in lilac, precisely?" asked Anna, smiling.
"Now, children, run along, run along. Do you hear? Miss Hull is calling you to tea," she said, tearing the children from her and sending them off to the dining room.
"I know why you're eager for me to come to the ball. You expect a great deal of this ball, and you want everyone to be there to take part in it."
"How do you know?" "Yes."
"Oh, how good it is to be your age," pursued Anna.
"I remember.
And I know that blue haze like the mist on the mountains in Switzerland. That mist which covers everything in that blissful time when childhood is just ending, and out of that vast circle, happy and gay, there is a path growing narrower and narrower, and it's delightful and alarming to enter the ballroom, bright and splendid as it is. Who has not been through it?"
Kitty smiled without speaking. "But how did she go through it?"
"How I'd like to know the whole romance of her life," thought Kitty, recalling the unromantic appearance of Alexei Alexandrovich, her husband.
"I know something. Stiva told me, and I congratulate you." "I liked him very much," Anna continued.
"I met Vronsky at the railway station."
"Oh, was he there?" asked Kitty, blushing. "What was it Stiva told you?"
"Stiva gossiped about it all. And I should be so glad. I travelled yesterday with Vronsky's mother," she went on, "and she talked without pause of him. He's her favourite. I know mothers are partial, but..."
"What did his mother tell you?"
"Oh, a great deal. And I know that he's her favourite. Still, one can see how chivalrous he is. Well, for instance, she told me that he had wanted to give up all his property to his brother, that he had done something extraordinary when he was a boy, saved a woman out of the water.
He's a hero, in fact," said Anna, smiling and recollecting the 200 rubles he had given at the station. But she didn't tell about the 200 rubles. For some reason it was unpleasant for her to think of it. She felt that there was something in it that had to do with her, something that ought not to have been.
"She was very eager for me to go and see her," Anna went on, "and I'll be glad to go and see her tomorrow. Stiva is staying a long while in Dolly's room, thank God," Anna added, changing the subject and getting up, Kitty thought, displeased with something.
"No, I'm first. No, me!" screamed the children, who had finished tea, running up to their Aunt Anna.
"All together," said Anna, and she ran laughing to meet them, and embraced and swung round the whole heap of children, shrieking with delight and struggling on the floor.